I understand how that happens.
Oh my goodness, yes. Okie dokes, so here we are. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Allie, nice to meet you and thank you for having me.
It's my honor to welcome you to the interview process for Yoga Radicals. This is the working title, Inspiring Stories from Pioneers in the Field. And so as I mentioned to you, we're gonna start with a little centering and then I'll go into the actual five-pointed star model that this is designed from, these questions that have evolved over the course of 3-10 years or so. And then we'll get into it. And of course, whatever happens is the right thing. So let's just get into that special spot that you have on the big body earth and let yourself settle. Sensing in the way that you know how, Gary, and just letting yourself feel and sense this moment in time and space where you are. And then I invite you to extend your awareness into our shared space, this generative field that is so active on the planet these days. And that we might dance between the two as we co-create from your embodied place a narrative that will serve those readers who come after. So the image that's coming to me right now is that you have an instrument to play and that there'll be a certain sound of it. So I just like to kind of land that in the space.
Beautiful.
If there's something that you'd like to land in the space before we launch.
Well, you know, when you said something a while ago, I thought of a beautiful Sanskrit word, aparusheya, which means it's used in the context of describing Vedic revelation. And the translation of the word is no human author. That it's not that we're creating this, but that from the depth of our own stillness, these teachings come through us and we become channels for something that's bigger than us.
Maybe so. So as I mentioned, these questions are inspired by what we've been developing at the Presencing Institute over the while at MIT with a large global community. And we're calling this really the prototyping model. It's used as the form of a star in order to both illustrate and map how the future is about paying attention to the quality of energy. And so what are those 5 points of the star as we co-create in these times the field of possibility, or as I like to say, open the field of potential, these portals that we, as you mentioned, are available to. And so number one, it's the crystallizing of a vision with intention. It's continuing to listen to the universe as a helpful place. And that as the intelligences of the head, the heart, and we call it the hand or the will, full-bodied presence, establishes itself in the personal body, then frequently teams or others come around us, other people. And then what we do is to find landing places and spaces. We like to call them strips of the future where it's safe to experiment. And then because this is a developmental model, we talk about learning by doing a lot. What do we iterate, create, fail fast in order to generate enough feedback from these other ways of learning?
Beautiful. It sounds exactly the only point in that star that I mean, I would use my own, I use my own language, but it's exactly what I teach, except that landing place for the future, that was interesting. It's different than, I'm looking forward to more comments about these things, but.
Perfect, thank you. So let's massage this portal around this emerging future that we're all kind of relaxing into after having self-sheltered now for a while. And so if these are initiatory times, then these first questions relate to the invocation of that emerging future. That's the whole point, right? There's welcoming quality of this co-initiation.
I come kind of from even though my life has been, well, that's another story, but there's a sort of a biblical sort of reference that comes up when you say this, which is there's nothing new under the sun. To me, this is just a continuation of what's been going on in consciousness from sort of lost in the mystery of time. I mean, it's not a new thing exactly.
So thank you for saying it, because it gives me an opportunity to mention my Quaker roots, my Gurdjieffian roots. I grew up in a Gurdjieff family. And so these integrative wisdom traditions that are now coming into our time are really like the waking up of these unbidden, formerly hidden, but now very essential parts of who we each are. So yeah, great. Mm-hmm. So paddle is in the water, man. You go quickly, don't you? So
well, as you said, that you know, the river's flowing to the ocean. Our last days, we don't know when they are, but they're coming soon. So
you got it. Perfect. So the request here, Gary, is to land in your embodied awareness around your story of really becoming a yogi, and then the offer that you've made to the world through your yogic practices. And the first question, going back to whenever, as when and how did your inspiration arise? What was the divine spark, and how did it hit?
All right, so just want to make sure, you're asking me to tell you a little bit my story about how I became conscious of who I am in this journey.
Correct.
Okay. So I don't want it to sound like a platitude, but I started out as a child, you know, at a very young age, I was asking my parents questions about the meaning of life and death. It kind of freaked them out. And I was very interested in to understand what was going on. I could sense in their personal dynamic tension and stress. And you know, when my grandfather died when I was a little boy, I mean, it already went like, what does that mean? What is death? So this is an early thing. And I went to I was interested in, at that time, my mother was interested in Chinese art, and she was an artist. And so I thought, I was interested in Lao Tzu. I encountered Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu, and I studied that stuff. This is in high school. I was born into a conservative but sort of secular Jewish family. I was sent to a synagogue, but there was no real religion in my personal family. But I got interested in Lao Tzu, and I went to college. And in the first semester, I took a course on Hinduism in the religious studies department. And for phys ed, I took karate. And I loved the Hinduism class. That karate didn't interest me because the teacher was just, the guy was, he was like a Korean War veteran, and his energy wasn't, and I weren't compatible. But the next semester, I took a course on Buddhism in the religious studies department, and I took the university's yoga class. I had encountered Patanjali in the first semester. Like, really, from that first semester in that Hinduism course, I encountered Patanjali, and my whole sort of orientation shifted from Lao Tzu, which I revered, of course, to Patanjali. And then next semester, I took this yoga class, and the woman was the wife of the chairman of the music department, who brought study groups of music students to South India, and she was a student of Krishnamacharya. So 6 months after I met her and took her first yoga class, they invited me to go to India with them. They were taking a group of music students. So this was in 1974. I went to Madras. It was called Madras back then. And I met Krishnamacharya and his son Deskachar. And for the academics, I went to Madras University and had a private tutorial in a tradition called Shaivite Siddhanta, which is a South Indian tantric Shaivite lineage. And the professor was actually a master, well-known, revered mystic. So I had this Shaivite Siddhanta immersion at Madras University with a private tutorial. We studied a text called the Tiruvasikam, which is in the tradition of bridal mysticism. That's a longer discussion, but it's the journey of the soul to God through the metaphor of the bride going to her wedding. And so I studied that, and I met Krishnamacharya, who was this Vaishnav master, and his son Deskachar, who was a Western sort of educated engineer. And so I started learning yoga from them, and my life work was the established then. You know, I became conscious of it. I graduated. I went back to the university after that 6 months in Madras, graduated and went back for 2 years. Then I went to graduate school in the religious studies department, and I met another sort of pivotal teacher in my life, a man named, who's also gone now, Raimundo Panikkar, who happened to have been, among other things, a Catholic priest, but fluent and wrote books in the original in seven languages, also had a PhD in physics. And, you know, one of those minds that are, once I was walking with him in the mountains in Switzerland with my ex-wife, and she said to him, how old are you? And he said, consciously, about 6,000 years. So he was not a normal. So I've had the blessing of being in contact with extraordinary teachers. I was also for 20 years, when I lived on Maui for 30 years, I was for 20 years on the board of directors of a Tibetan Dharma Society. So my life journey is shaped by religious studies and world religions. And I have, you know, all the coursework. I'm an ABD, all but dissertation. I studied Sanskrit for decades, and my life's journey is really, the yoga that I'm involved with is very different than the popular yoga in the West, let's say that.
Great, great. Thank you. So, next question is about the connection to something that's potentially actionable, right? You said my life's work is informed by what you just said. So now it's kind of like a convergence process on you landing as a result of all of this with some seed that might become the way in which you work in the world. Can you talk a little bit about how you crafted your offer, let's call it, you know, in the way in which you made your teaching?
Well, so first of all, you know, this journey from childhood trying to figure out what's going on led me by, I landed in Madras when I was 19 years old. So really it led me at quite a young age to these teachers. And I felt at that time, I didn't think about career. I thought about passion for truth, really, to learn and understand. And I had this sort of young, really a boy, even before being a man, I had an insight that all of the world's traditions must contain gems of truth. And if there was contradictions or apparent contradictions, it just means, or paradoxes, it just means that I haven't understood enough. So what motivated me in my initial journey was to understand and to see the lived wisdom that's expressed in different language through different traditions, but to find that kind of unity underneath it, what they were really saying about the nature of reality and who I am and what is this divine thing and what's my relationship to the world around me and to the divine. That's just been my quest. And once, when 1 year, it was about 1977, my teacher in India said, you know, you need to become a yoga teacher. And I was like, why? He said, because otherwise, how are you going to make a living? Then you have to do something else that'll take you away from your journey. And he said to me that he gave me this term, pratinidhi, which means something like ambassador. That was interesting. And he said that I was conceiving my own sort of relationship as I began teaching as translating ancient insights in a modern context. And he said, you are a teacher. He also told me I should write books. He told me, I was a religious studies student. In 1976, he told me that I should go to medical school. And I said, why? And he said, because in the future, you'll be bringing yoga therapy into the context of Western healthcare, which to me didn't make any sense. It's happened, of course, but my deeper interest is still this inner work. So for me, it's like being a translator, a communicator, a teacher, an educator, and then also I have the role as a therapist because I wasn't what I was looking for, but I received it and I understand how to use it. So I've been very involved with that as well. I don't know if I'm answering your question, actually.
Oh, it's perfect. It's perfect. No, I'm wondering just a little bit because I'm thinking ahead to this word truth. And if we call it seekers of the truth is kind of the subtext in the whole Gurdjieff cosmology. And if it's true, Gary, that one of the essential human questions is this search, right, for some kind of coherence of inner, outer, existence, life, however you want to name it, we need to offer a pointed statement around where truth landed in your body, so that there might be a sensory connection. And I don't know if you've tracked it like that, or if there's a place, a location, a land and locate kind of question, so that that yeah. became your well.
You know, so I, here's the symbol system that I use to, in response to that question. It's what I would call the heart mind. And in fact, I do a series of inner practice retreats that are called heart-mind retreats. And you know, you said something earlier in the beginning of our discussion, and you used the word, it was right before you used the word will. So it's our thoughts, our mind, our self-concept, and the narrative we're telling ourselves about ourselves and the world around us. It's our changing feelings and emotions, moods, but mostly that feeling quality. And then it's our behavior, our action, which is related to our will. And all of that kind of comes from our, we say in the tradition, our desires, which themselves come from our conditioning. So for me, in my personal path, I would say that there's a jnana quality. And for me, the first thing that happened was an awakening of awareness. So it was, I wouldn't say it's in my mind. It was more in my heart mind, because it was the place where my understanding and my feelings converged. That was at the root, you know, and then to let that guide my choices moving forward. And then I could feel for myself the reality of my own unresolved issues, my conditioning, wanting me to become attached to things and identified with things in the world and success, like in relation to my dad, like he was a businessman, my brother was making big success in business, and I'm going to India to study yoga. So I could feel the tension between wanting to meet the expectations of my family that I had taken on myself and listening to the guidance of these deeper teachings. And I feel blessed or lucky that for me, they just converged. And that's, you know, what's the spark of the career came from direct instruction from my teacher, but also where it was a place where my growing understanding, my feelings, and my action could converge and keep me on the path. You know, my prayer was, help me stay on the path. Help me stay, you know, and find a way to manifest it in the world. And sort of, I don't know if that makes sense.
It totally makes sense, because if the funnel of that convergence, you know, through space and time creates some momentum, right? This staying on the path through these intentions, that's really what we're looking at as shaping the quality of how these body-centered practices, mental convergence with universal life force.
And then dancing with the tension of the being pulled into this and that by the world around me and my own unresolved issues has been the field in which I've grown and matured.
Right, so that great wobble, I like to call it, just like the Mayans talked to us about when the calendar was shifting, that we're in a big time now. Tell us, what were some of your biggest challenges about the staying on the path, your prayer, and what yogic principles or other sutras, transmissions helped you?
Oh my goodness. Well, so I would say that from early on, one of the things that I articulated to myself really in the 1970s was that this is a path in which there is no doubt. You know, there is, like I had, as a mature person now, I would say that I had somehow this implicit faith in the truth of these teachings. And when I say these teachings, it's not limited to the yoga tradition that I was receiving. It's the world's collective understanding that was transmitted from in my sort of exposure to world religious tradition. So I became a student of world religion. And my job was to make these teachings alive and real in my own life. And I think that, when I was a young man, the first challenge was, how do I make a living in society and stay in Dharma, stay in integrity with what my inner sort of orientation was, and how do I not compromise? And my teacher said, just teach. And, it was interesting because when I first started teaching yoga, people came to me with back problems, and then they were coming to me with sleep issues, and then they were coming to me with depression. And so like it naturally evolved, the depth of the work evolved naturally. And then at a certain point, I mean, I had my own unresolved conditioning or patterns. And so I was wanting to be with a woman. And there was this whole community. I lived in Maui back in the 70s. And there was this whole community of people got into yoga. But what they were into was very different than what I had learned. They were into Ashtanga yoga, if you know what that is. It's just an exercise system. Although their guru was a student of my teacher. So, do you know what I mean? I was like, and then the other side of it was there was a tantric movement emerging in Maui. And for them, that was California sex therapy. And I had studied in Madras, Shaivite Siddhanta Tantra. And then I took refuge. I mean, I met those people and I was like, well, gosh, I was afraid of it. I mean, I'm sure I needed it. But it wasn't the tantra that I had learned. And that year, 1976, a Tibetan Lama was sent by Kalu Rinpoche. I don't know if you know much about Tibetan Buddhism, but so Lama Tenzin established the Karma Rime Osaling, which means all sex, S-E-C-T-S, radiating clear light. So I took refuge with Lama. I became on the board of directors of his Dharma Center for 20 years. So I was studying. So for me, the challenge was, as a young man with lots of energy, including sexual energy, growing up in Hawaii, where there was all this tantric, not the tantra that I knew, but, you know, and so I took refuge with the Tibetan Dharma, and then I found a woman, and I got married. But boy, that opened my eyes to a whole other reality. So marriage was a challenge. Having a child, I have a son, was a challenge. Divorce was a challenge. And each of these challenges helped me grow. And then in 2004, I got diagnosed with a brain tumor. So that was a huge one. You know, I had anyway, I'm fine. But I have had three major brain surgeries. So, you know, the point is that life has brought me lots of pivotal points and critical moments. The brain surgery was huge. It was probably bigger than any of the others, except meeting my teachers, of course. But that was an amazing teacher. It was like, you know, and a lot of the work I'm doing now is teaching people, the therapists, meditations to prepare for end of life. Not the hospice work. We do that as well in yoga therapy, but really more how we can understand the meaning of life in the face of the reality of change and permanence and death. So maybe my real answer to your question is it's just pain and suffering and life challenges and struggling with my own desires and trying to stay in integrity with my Dharma have all been pivotal points in deepening my journey and helping me understand it. And actually, one last thing I'll say is that every time I faced something like that, I was in a different position to work with people who are going through it. I mean, after brain surgery, it's not that I knew something different, but the people that came to me with life-threatening or terminal illnesses related to me in a different way, or I was able to be present with them in a different way. So life experience has been what's deepened my journey.
Great, thank you. So as you talk, I'm experiencing a very expansive capacity and then a very microcosmic capacity of attention, Gary. And the Krishnamurti, of course, the undying daily, and these whole precepts that prepare us, right, are something that I'm hearing very alive and well in you as a translator of some of these world traditions and concepts. So if that's true,
Can I just add an aside just there? I happen to have met Krishnamurti, an opportunity to be, because he was a student of Krishnamacharya. He became a student, and then Krishnamacharya told him in 1963 to study with Deskachar. And so I got to be with him several times with in a group of 15 people. And definitely, like, Deskachar gave me a little teeny book that was signed by Krishnamurti, that Krishnamurti gave him that copy. And it was called Freedom from the Known. So there's a history there with Krishnamurti.
Okay, so we've landed, because this is the next question. It's about crystallizing, right? Mm. And so if your attention around these very complex parts of being human right now in this time really gave you a landing strip, right? We're back at that place of this landing strip. Where did you extend it to others? How did you create a team or a group? How did that work for you?
So, I mean, you know, for me, it started with, and the field of yoga is rooted in personal practice. And that it's in the actual, what we call sadhana, the actual working with ourselves in relationship to ourselves. And recognizing that we as human beings are multidimensional, and that the sadhana is multidimensional, and what we're doing with yoga sadhana and yoga practice is creating a conscious relationship with ourselves at a multidimensional level. And then recognizing an expanded understanding of what self is. So I have the whole field of asana is people misunderstand it. Asana is not about asana. Asana is just a means of helping us create a conscious relationship with our functional anatomy so that we can create stability and strength and range of motion and maintain it through life. But we're not just that. We're also an autonomic nervous system. So the field of pranayama is like creating a conscious relationship with our autonomic nervous system so that we can create sympathetic, parasympathetic regulation. And it goes on like that. And our relationship with our changing emotions, our relationship with our stories, the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, our narrative, and that's really big today, what's going on in the world and our interpretation, then our relationship to each other. So the expanded notion of self. And so I feel like for me, it's been a process of using sadhana to understand and then to work to refine my relationship to myself, which in an expanded notion of self through sadhana, and then start communicating that to people. There's two kinds of people that I think two sort of motivations that inspire people to do something at a new level. One is pain and suffering. And the other is a mysterious deep inner longing or interest or passion for truth. And so, a lot of the people that I work with, it's because they're suffering and they want to find a way of refining relieving suffering. And in our path, it's a way of understanding yourself. Find out what you're doing habitually that's either causally or complicating the healing, causing the suffering or maintaining it, and what you can, and stop doing those things, and what you can start doing that can help you find healing or transformation. So I think that if I've understood your question correctly, but for me, it was the landing point, and then bringing it is through communicating with people who are looking for either relief from pain or connecting to something beyond themselves.
Thank you. So with this heart and mind together, now as a translator from all of your history and then creating these curricula around this particular, you mentioned our path. Could you tell our readers the qualities and experiences of people who have learned from your path?
Okay. Wow. These are huge questions, aren't they? I mean, there's different aspects of my work. And so there are people that have spent years, decades even, studying movement with me. But usually people who are interested in movement and then applying it in relation to structural therapy. So, I'm talking about us in our community. We tell people, I use a metaphor, what's more important for yoga people particularly, what's more important, your hamstrings or your liver? And very rarely does someone say hamstrings, obviously. So then I say movement is to hamstrings what breath work is to liver. And so training people how to use their own respiratory system to influence their autonomic nervous system, to be able to help self-regulate and influence all of their physiology, and then also to use that work to influence their emotions. Because then the next question is, what's more important, your liver or your attitude? So then how to use breath, and then introducing the power of sound and chanting and mantra of any language, of course, to influence the mind, to influence emotions and mind, and then to create relationship with something beyond the mind. So people that have sort of studied in, when I say our path, it's an integrated, recognizing that, I would use this phrase, and it comes from Taittiriya Upanishad through my sort of weird American translation, working with the multidimensionality of the human system, and the ancients evolved tools to help us create a conscious relationship with ourselves at a multidimensional level, and refine that relationship so that we both eliminate sources of suffering at a multidimensional level, but also actualize our highest potential that's revealed and transmitted through the tradition.
Beautiful. Thank you. So let's just take a pause here in order to let this shared space land. Again, these divergent and yet very convergent ways of learning. And thinking again to the readers who are coming after.
Can I add one thing? I apologize. But the doorway in, and this is important, and this is what we train teachers to do, can be varied. You can enter the door through this, people have back pain or neck tension, or want to learn handstand, or people that are having sleep issues, or they have high blood pressure, or they're athletes, or people that are having emotional issues. You know, so that you can enter, we train teachers to be able to meet a student where they are and enter any door that's accessible and either stay there, because that's all the student ever is interested in, or guide them as they deepen their understanding to expand their ability to work with themselves at a multidimensional level. I guess I added that.
So there's that places of potential that we spoke about relative to the future, enabling a future where more of us are beginning to come online, so to speak.
Come online. I like that, yeah.
So if this direction of your practice, your path, your own life narrative, Gary, is enabling people to both move toward the relief of something, right? That's really actually a moving away from something.
Exactly, yes.
And then this nexus or yantra, I like to call this moment of actually beginning to learn to reach toward something. Can you speak a little bit more from the esoteric grounding and maybe a few world traditions about the boundaries that we must face and cross over, these mini deaths, you know, that are so prevalent in the scripture, in order to stay in the heart mind and avoid the fear?
Wow.
I mean, so, this is, right? This is what's happening.
Yes.
Now,
there's a couple of things that I would say about that, you know, or many things. First of all, you know, the yoga tradition says that the first jnanam is dukkham. That means the first awakening or knowledge is that they're suffering. And biblically, of course, you know, which is a slightly different translation. The standard translation is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Do you understand? Although the Hebrew word that's usually translated fear would be more accurately in the way we use the language today, translated as awe, A-W-E, which is a very different sort of take than fear. What I've seen is that there's either the motivation to move away from where we are because it's painful, or there's a fascination, this is what I already said, of looking forward. I use the image of the mountain and the valley, Most of us are living at the valley. Some of us are living in the valley, looking up in the mountaintop and thinking it's great, but life is on the valley. Some of us begin the journey of ascent. Some of us walk up the mountain partway and then we hang out. But there are a few that go, that keep going on that journey all the way to the mountaintop. And so I think that our job is to, and first of all, point to people that, hey, there's the mountaintop. And you're here, and is it good here? That's great. Can you refine it? Can you begin to walk away from your entanglement? I mean, what our tradition, meaning Vedic tradition that I was trained in, called the world of name and form. That's called samsara in the Buddhist tradition, that we're entangled in the world of name and form. And how do we both appreciate the blessings of this life and refine it and elevate each other towards the mountaintop kind of thing? And then there are some people that are walking ahead, you know, that are journeying up. And I think we have a lot of problems in our world today because of what my teacher Panikkar used to call, sorry for this, not sorry for this phrase, but it's, I think you'll have the mind to understand it, cross-cultural mutual fecundation, which means, yeah, that's Panikkar. It's that we have the potential to enrich each other. Swami Rama would say that when you're walking up the path, I met Swami Rama, I don't know if you know who he was. He's been long gone. But
I've heard his name. I don't know much.
He was a Siddha, and he was an awakened master. He was studied in, like, Menninger Institute. They could put him in a room and then read a book on the other side, and he would tell them what they were reading. Then he would change his body weight. Like, he could, anyway, that's another discussion. But
cool.
You know, that when you're walking up the path, it seems like that's the only way. But when you get to the top, you can see that there's all kinds of paths. So we have this cross-cultural misunderstanding, and what we need to translate it into is cross-cultural, as Panikkar says, mutual fecundation means enrichment and nourishing each other and honoring the differences, but recognizing the underlying unity there. And we're having that, not only did we have that, like with the, you know, the interfaith conflict, we need more interfaith dialogue. And not only do we need more interfaith dialogue, but we need inner geopolitical dialogue and all of this polarization that's going on, this growing fragmentation that we have because people are identifying with their narrative and they're not seeing what's really going on. I mean, we're moving towards crisis, I think, because a lack of awareness, a lack of understanding, too much identification with our narrative.
Thing. So this moving from me to we place is really the place of letting go of a tremendous amount of identification with the personal narrative. And so if the awakening of this shared root, Gary, is actually possible, if this is one of the potential openings of our time, even without learning from the wisdom traditions around these unification principles of from all that is, tell us, in fact, where, yeah, this is not a how yet, but it's a where we might look as an individual searcher for the truth.
What an interesting question. So there's a beautiful ancient Chinese expression that says, nothing that enters through the front gate can be a family treasure. Isn't that beautiful? And, you know, one of the things that Krishnamacharya said, he didn't say it and he didn't create it. It comes from Gita, Bhagavad Gita. So Krishna, that better half a life lived Svadharma than a whole life Paradharma. So Paradharma is somebody else's. Sva is what's your own. And I think that the journey of this work is for helping individuals uncover their own true Svadharma, the treasure that exists in their heart. You know, in China, the treasure was buried in the hearth. And so for me, that's a metaphor of the heart. And it's already in us. And our job is not to import it from India or China or, you know, but to awaken to that treasure that's already buried inside of us.
I love it.
That's kind of a guiding principle for me in my work with people. Yeah. We're not converting people, we're helping them wake up to the treasure that's already within them.
So I just want to slide over to the Sufis here, because one of the things that they really instruct on the way to the mountain or on the way is to stay standing in front of the beloved. So I'm thinking about your structural work with the body and the skeleton and everything else, that we're upright creatures. We forgot, you know, and our hearts used to be connected to the earth when we were four-footed. So tell us a little bit about why it's important to learn how to stand on the earth, Gary.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, one of the things that I learned is that, and Krishnamacharya told me when I was a young man, that one of the most important goals of yoga is sthiti. Sthiti is the root, the Sanskrit root sthiti is connected, the sthiti is a word that's connected to the root sta, which is connected to the English word stand. And to be established, like an establishment is to be stable. They're all the same etymological roots. So to be able to stand in yourself on the earth, you know, an expanded understanding of stand, of self rather. So to me, standing means to be stable. And I think that's the starting point. We were taught that the starting point in all of this is to create stability. Stability structurally, of course, but also stability physiologically, which means immunity, and perhaps more important, stability emotionally, because things are changing. And then just to be stable. So, and if you're not stable, you can't perform, you can't function. So being stable on the earth, I'm maybe not exactly answering your question, but you know, that's the way I would respond to it. That's the starting point of our work. And actually, if you look at the metaphor or the symbol system of the chakras, which is an ancient, another thing misunderstood largely in the yoga world, the root foundation is Muladhara, which means that root support. That is the foundation that can give you the sense of safety and trust from where you can then create your life. So it's very important that we're, you know, and if we talk about embodiment, we are in the ancient tradition of all the traditions of the world, by the way, not just the Vedic traditions, but you can see it in Judaism and Christianity. At least I don't have the same level of training in Islam, although I have some. Is this what we would call the Catholic Church calls it the Trinity, right? So the Trikaya or Triya Sharira. Trikaya is Buddhism. Have you studied some Buddhism?
So oh, yes. Dharma,
yeah.
Theravada.
Okay. So, well, this is my training is more Vajrayana, although I started my study in Theravada, actually. Interesting. That's another story. But Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. You know that language. So the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, those are the triple body. So we're manifest in the gross plane. Here we are. And so we're grounded and stable here. And this is the place that we've been given. This is where we can create the garden. We come back to the Bible, right? So this is our work. And we can't create until we find stability and safety from where we can begin to do the work together.
There it is. So this law of three, or these Trinitarian concepts, relate very specifically to at least the seven system chakra orientation. And so as we reflect here now, knowing that these ancient practices and symbols, and I love that you're calling in the symbols so that people will feel curious to find their own relationship with symbols as we
are living symbols to that are awakened for them.
And so these next couple of questions, we're coming down the pike here.
This is really fun, by the way.
Isn't it? I know. I can just watch the world be so excited with the way that you put things together. It's lovely. It's very educated, and it's also very real. So I just want to name that right now.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So if the translator in you, right? Come on. This is really what I'm learning from you. And that you were given permission somewhere in your DNA and, you know, blah, 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 on it comes. That you stayed on the path. Mr. Kruskal, Mr. Gary. And, you know, you got these young ones coming around. They're saying, hey, man, what do you got? I need to know. And they're also looking for something new. So here's the precept, that there is always this portal into something else. We don't know what it is. It's back to that threshold question, Gary. Help us just kind of land in a more generative, easy to understand way of accepting that it's an ongoing process, this staying on the path, and that the new is a continuous new.
Well, I would say, look, you're asking, yeah, I love your questions, by the way. You know, there's this idea of entropy. So there, and I'm not a great physicist, but there's this idea of quantum, and what's negentropic? If I may be misusing these metaphors, I taught recently means in the past 5 years down in Irvine to a bunch of physicists, so they said it's okay to use these words this way. You know, consciousness is negentropic; it's ever expanding. The Sanskrit word is ananta. I said ananta. It's ananta. It's infinite. It's unending. It's ever expanding. So that just opens us up to this mystery, and it's an ongoing process of expanding beyond our sort of time and space bound self-concept. So for me, it's interesting. There's a word in Sanskrit called pranava. Pranava is Om for Hindus. Mm-hmm. And Om is that sound that is the living presence of the infinite. That's longer discussion, obviously. But the meaning of the word pranava is that which is always new.
Oh, wow.
So that's the root of it. So that when you express it, and that's, remember we began with aparusheya?
Yes.
So the idea of aparusheya is that the opposite of aparusheya is like, I wrote a book. I have knowledge. I put it down. I'm the authority anterior to the book that you might read. With the pranava, with revelation, it's you're listening to it and it's being created new in each moment. It's like, I know you said more simple. This isn't simple, but the idea is that as we come into stillness, and continue to do the work of emptying ourselves of ourselves.
Right.
So that we can be in full presence, then creation keeps coming, the new keeps coming.
So
one last thing let me add. There's an ancient symbol system that's universal. And like you can see it in ancient, I don't know if you studied any, if you know about Kabbalah.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so basically the Vedic term is Shushumna.
Yes.
So when I was a little kid, you asked me how I started. When I was a little kid, I remember watching Bugs Bunny. And maybe we're a similar age. I'm 65. I don't know where you are, but.
I got three on you.
Okay. So I remember this Bugs Bunny cartoon, and it was like pre what's this current, politically incorrect or correct thing. So Bugs Bunny was a sheikh. He had a turban and he was in the desert. And I don't know if you saw this. It was a little teeny tent.
Yes, I remember.
And he sticks his head in the tent. And it was like the Met or New York or something. So it's kind of like, and actually Warner Brothers created Bugs Bunny, and they must have been the precursor of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is cartoon. And, so he puts his head in the tent and it's this vast amphitheater. He pulls his head out and his neck gets long and wraps around the tent. And to me, that was like an epiphany. That's the central channel. That, or if you think about Doctor Who or, Mary Poppins with her bag, which is, it's this center of our being is the doorway to the infinite within us. That Vedic people call the Shushumna Moksha Marga, which is
right.
The path to freedom.
There it is. So this ability to stay standing with the Shushumna, and this connection to what is above and what is below, right? Such a classic way that people learn alignment these days. This allows something else to open. So as we kind of finish out here, and you know that we're gonna push the button to say goodbye, what else, Gary? What else wants to be shared?
gratitude for somebody like you and this sangha of people you're gathering who speak this ancient language that resonated through time and space that is inspiring our lives. And just the offering or the hope or the wish that I offer myself to this vision that you have, because mm-hmm. as you hear, I mean, it's speaking everything that I have been blessed to receive. Have you ever heard of Chakrapani? He's gone now, but he was one of the great classic Jyotishis, Vedic astrologers.
But I don't know his name. I know Jyotish, yes.
Yeah, so he's gone now, but he was generational Jyoti. And he met me, I met him, is the other way of saying it, two decades ago. Mm. And he said, in my chart, I have a very unusual thing, which is these they're called yogas, but it's different use of the word yoga in relation to Jyotish. And it means that my life will bring me into contact with world teachers from different traditions. Mm. That's just what it's been. And for me to meet, you ask what's left, what needs to be said in this space, is like you're listening to the same messages. I can feel it. And if you're gathering people that are hearing it this way, I think that there's a collective work that we can do together to bring these teachings forward. Panikkar, who was one of my main teachers, was the guy that started the first interfaith dialogue conferences at United Nations.
Oh my.
So he's influenced a lot of the way I bring these teachings forward. I wish what you're doing great success. We say Shubha Mastu, may the best things happen. But just know that this is my life's mission. If there's any way that I can share with you and support what you're doing, please know I'm here.
Oh, Gary, I am seeing the network move out from your spine and heart. It's just a beautiful thing to observe. And that your commitment lands on the movement outward as you contain your own and have released your conditioning, right? Isn't that the story of most people's lives? But let's just imagine that more people will gather it up too.
Yeah. Can I share one more thing with you?
Of course.
When I was young, I thought I was, in my 20s, I was going to go up to the mountain.
Yeah.
And Deskachar told me that his father said to tell me that the Nivritti Marga, which is that path of going into the mountain, Nivritti means stopping to be engaged in the world,
right,
is in this yuga not relevant. That you must do what's called Pravritti, which is go into the world and share this teaching and do something useful for all beings.
Okay, from the cave to the people.
That's what I was taught as a young man, yeah. My path was redirected.
But you listened, that's the good news.
Yeah.
Okie dokie.
It's an honor and pleasure. I hope our paths cross again.
It would be nice.
Will you share with me what the evolution of this, or?
Absolutely. So yeah, the evolution is that I have to write and hand in the manuscript by the end of September. I'll be looking for an editor, and then they're going to be trying to launch it in 2021. It's part of the attempt to create a little bit more heart-centeredness at the IAYT as the lineages continue to do what they're doing. So there's unknowns, but I will keep in touch. The singing and will come to you and ask for some bio, more officially type stuff.
Sure. Well, it's an honor. Be safe and healthy and happy.
You too. Thank you so much, Gary.
Thank you. My pleasure. Take care.
Bye for now.
Bye.